Unsealed documents show former Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron investigated two physicians who provided abortion care in the state when it was legal to do so. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll hear more about this court battle and why it was hidden from the public. Plus, Cincinnati public school leaders and community members look for solutions to violent incidents involving students at bus stops, and we remember baseball legend Pete Rose and his legacy complicated by scandal. Joining me now to talk about this Kentucky court case are Kentucky Lantern reporter Tom Loftus and Kentucky Lantern editor-in-chief Jamie Luke. Thanks so much for being here, Tom and Jamie.
Happy to be here.
Tom, take us to the beginning of this legal battle. How and when did it start?
Well, actually, its origins go back several years. Two doctors at EMW Women's Surgical Center in Louisville, a place that performed abortions while it was legal, are also doctors at the University of Louisville. And an issue that Family Foundation and some legislators have been pressing is there any improper use of state funds that pay these doctors at the University of Louisville? In short, the question was, are state dollars being used to pay for abortions, which is not legal? And they pressed it. The University of Louisville officials say, no, these are separate situations and so forth. And that didn't satisfy some of the critics and some of the Republican legislators from Louisville. And they kept the issue in play. The question was... Attorney General Cameron, in a civil suit, attempted to obtain, through the discovery process in that case, the payroll records of these doctors at the EMW clinic, and failed. He was unable to do so. When he failed, in June of 2023, he issued a subpoena from the Franklin County Grand Jury here in Frankfort to obtain those records. The doctors, in turn, and an official of the clinic responded by filing a case here in Franklin County asking that the subpoena be quashed, that it was oppressive and irrelevant, and they allege that General Cameron, who at the time, this is June of last year, was just launching his, had just come off fresh from winning the Republican primary for governor as a candidate. He was a strident pro-life candidate. He was running for governor, and they said that he was going about this whole exercise for political purposes. And that's how it all got started. The case proceeded in Franklin Circuit. The judge quashed the subpoena, and he ordered the case unsealed last September in the throes of when the stretch run of the governor's race, at a time when the politics of abortion had changed, as it has nationally. Most people favor exceptions in instances of rape or incest, and frankly, at the time, Daniel Cameron was having a little bit of difficulty with that issue, as Governor Beshear, his opponent, was running ads attacking him on that, very effective ads attacking him on that point. Cameron appealed the ruling in Franklin Circuit, of course, the subpoena, and he also filed motions to keep this case sealed. It was sealed at the outset. The judge here in Franklin County, Philip Shepard, with his order quashing the subpoena, attempted to unseal it, but he was thwarted by Cameron, who, in the middle of the campaign, wanted to keep this case sealed. He won an order from the Court of Appeals to do so, and everything remained secret until August, when the Court of Appeals ruled, affirming Shepard, that the subpoena should be quashed. Hmm.
Jamie, how did this case end up sealed in the first place?
At the very beginning, after Cameron was unable to get the information he...
Oops, I think we... Yep. I'm sorry, you broke up there just a bit, but you said at the very beginning when after Attorney General Cameron was unable to get the information he was seeking?
Through the discovery process and the case, the challenge, Kentucky's abortion right at turned EMW and court to try to get an injunction to keep abortion legal in Kentucky, and ultimately did not succeed in that. But after he struck out through that route, he used the Franklin, the very day that the court ruled that, no, you can't get this information through discovery, he issued a subpoena under the name of the Franklin County Grand Jury, but he never ran that by the grand jury. There was no presentation to the grand jury or vote by the grand jury to seek this financial information from physicians. Mm.
And Tom, was the original sealing, was that an effort to keep the doctors' identities private so that they weren't retaliated against?
Exactly. When the doctors filed their case to quash the subpoena, they were the ones who asked it to be sealed and to keep their names out of this matter. And Cameron at that time agreed with that, and Judge Shepard here in Franklin County allowed the case to proceed through the summer, sort of until further notice that it would remain sealed.
Mm-hmm. So this was, Tom, is my timeline correct that this case was sealed, that the fact that all this was happening was basically kept from the public for more than a year, is that right?
Correct. It's a very unusual in that respect. And when Judge Shepard tried to unseal it last September, just about a year ago, he went to great lengths talking about the importance how important it is that court cases, that the public have open courts, that things proceed in the open. But then again, he was stalled and everything by Cameron's appeal, and this case, as I say, proceeded all the way until August, when the Court of Appeals ruled in Shepard's favor to quash the subpoena, but it issued a very unusual order. It still identified the plaintiffs in the original case as Jane Doe 1 and Jane Doe 2, and the clinic manager as, or clinic official as, John Rowe, and it did not mention EMW or anyone's names in the opinion. But if you read the opinion, especially if you've covered the abortion issue here in Kentucky, which frankly our colleague Deborah Yetter has done for decades, you didn't have to be Bob Woodward to figure out what they were talking about in the Court of Appeals opinion.
Mm-hmm. What and it you know, I appreciate that you didn't have to be Bob Woodward. Were they saying, first let me back up, what were the concerns that were being raised by the lawyers for these doctors? I mean, why, what was their argument? And it sounds like maybe the Court of Appeals kind of agreed with them.
Well, the concern they had, among others, is that this would be used for political purposes and expressly expressed fear that they could become, the doctors could become victims of vilification, perhaps even physical harm and harassment, if this became, if their names were public and it became known. They said that this was a strictly a political move by General Cameron on the abortion issue for the purposes of advancing his chances to be elected governor. Now, Cameron said that, in reply, said that that was nonsense, that was slander. He had an important issue that needed to be investigated. He needed the records to show one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. And what? But the appeals court did not side with the attorney, the former attorney general.
In the end, the appeals court said agreed with Shepard. Basically, both courts said this was a fishing expedition. First of all, he was bringing the case in the wrong county. All of the conduct by these doctors occurred in Louisville, in Jefferson County. They said he had not been invited by the local prosecutor here in Franklin County, and that the grand jury itself didn't do anything on this case. That Cameron had unilaterally obtained a subpoena from the Franklin Circuit Court clerk, and did it all on his own. So it was the wrong venue. Secondly, they said the evidence just simply did not support the fact that the underlying allegation at issue here, and that the Court of Appeals said that the doctors are employees of EMW, and they are paid by EMW for any abortion services, and that the Commonwealth of Kentucky certainly directly is not making any payments that for abortion services. Hmm.
Jamie, I understand we have you on the phone now. We were having some problems with our connection. How did these records finally get unsealed?
Well, after the Court of Appeals ruled in August, the question of unsealing the records was sent back to Circuit Judge Shepard, and he set a hearing in the Kentucky Lantern, and Louisville Public Media intervened. We hired a First Amendment lawyer, and we asked that they be unsealed. And a week later, Shepard did that, and a day or so later, we actually got the records. And I think one thing that's important to say, if I may, right now, is that the physicians are U of L faculty members. And one reason it was so important for them to do the work at EMW is that they were training residents and medical students, and to be an accredited medical school, people learning to be OBGYNs need to know how to do abortions. And, of course, that hasn't been happening in Kentucky now for more than 2 years.
Hmm. Jamie, now that the records have been unsealed, I know you, Tom and you spent a whole lot of time looking through them. What kind of response have you all heard at the Kentucky Lantern from former Attorney General Cameron or from Kentucky's current Attorney General, Russell Coleman?
The is silence, Lucy. We haven't heard a thing. And we have asked. We have made efforts to interview them. Hmm.
And Tom, are there any questions you're still trying to answer about this whole case? I know there's still some information that's sealed, right?
Well, we do have some lingering questions. First of all, there's some records at the Court of Appeals that we have not attempted yet to look at those records. But I think an important point is when this case ended after the Court of Appeals ruling, current Attorney General Russell Coleman has decided not to ask the Kentucky Supreme Court to grant discretionary review to hear an appeal of the Court of Appeals' ruling. So this particular case is completely over. Now, I'm sure the issue will be kicked around by advocates on both sides, but this case is over, and I don't know or not, but you know, perhaps Russell Coleman feels that this issue for legal purposes or political purposes just ain't worth pressing on at this point.
Well, I've been talking with Kentucky Lantern reporter Tom Loftus and Kentucky Lantern editor-in-chief Jamie Luke. Thank you both so much for your time today and for this reporting.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll hear the latest on violent incidents involving students at bus stops. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati Public Schools leaders and community members are looking for solutions to violent incidents involving students at Metro bus stops. Joining me now to discuss the problem and the search for solutions are Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Thanks for being here, Cameron.
No problem.
And WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Thank you, Lucy.
Cincinnati Public Schools and Metro are both financial supporters of Cincinnati Public Radio. Zach, remind us what happened at the school board meeting where Police Chief Thiege spoke.
Yeah, so last week, the chief came in. It was a bit of a surprise visit. She did not tell the school board or the president that she was going to be there. But basically, she gave a presentation kind of breaking down some of the incidents that have happened since the start of the school year, particularly at four transit hubs in the city. She mentioned that, you know, crime and youth violence is down across the city, but at these four transit hubs, it's spiked since the start of the school year. So she basically said that this has become a huge safety issue, both for students and for police. And she was really worried that it was going to escalate if things continued. And she called upon the school board and the school district to do something, basically. And essentially, she implied that she wanted CPS employees there at the transit hubs or somebody there at the transit hubs to do something about this, to keep an eye on these kids, to make sure they're not getting in trouble.
Cameron, what kind of behaviors was the chief talking about? Can you give us any specifics?
Yeah, so she ran off a ton of things. She said that there had been 30 arrests of juveniles, and 20 of those had been of Cincinnati Public School students. And several of them were actually this conversation has been happening for over a year now about kids and busing and this whole triad of Metro and Cincinnati Public Schools and the police have all, you know, kind of gone in circles for a while now. But this is the first time we've heard about a lot of incidents in Oakley and at Oakley Station. So there were in August, that first few weeks of school, there was a group of juveniles who refused to leave the theater there. In early September, there was apparently a brawl at Oakley Station, and six juveniles who were all public school, Cincinnati public school students, were identified as participants in that. September 11th, a group of 15 juveniles, including at least one CPS student, was involved in an aggravated assault. And then September 19th, again at Oakley Station, there was apparently gunshots fired, and the police characterized it as mass brawls and chaos, which prompted businesses to shelter in place.
Hmm. Zach, did the chief say that she and her department had been trying to work with CPS on this?
Yeah, she had mentioned that with the previous superintendent, Ironetta Wright, that she had reached out to the school district and basically had heard nothing as far as trying to work with them and create some sort of plan. Now, with the new interim superintendent, Shauna Murphy, when she spoke last week, they said that they had not really had a conversation. I believe Shauna Murphy said they have spoke since that time, but they are looking to kind of set up some sort of kind of formal meeting to go into detail about these issues. But, you know, before this, you know, even if they were presenting a image that they were working together, apparently that wasn't the case. They really hadn't been working together on these issues before now. Hmm.
Cameron, you had mentioned that, you know, there are three big organizations involved in this: Cincinnati Public Schools, Cincinnati Police Department, and Metro, the bus service. Is there a question of who's responsible for student behavior when they're on the bus or out in the community? Is that one of the complicating factors here?
Yeah, so depending on who you talk to, the question is phrased differently, and the question is phrased specifically. Who's responsible for the children is one question. Also, who is responsible for keeping them safe? Who's responsible for making sure they get home? And it's sort of a very kind of circular thing that happens where you have Cincinnati Public Schools saying that they've used Metro for as long as anyone can remember to get their kids to and from school. And since the 1970s, there were these things called extra routes that were specifically designed for the needs of schools. They weren't only used for students, but they were designed to help kids get where they needed to go. And a few years ago, those routes went away, and the Cincinnati Public Schools have said that has caused a lot of disruption. More kids need transfers. More kids need to go down to Government Square or these transit centers to make those transfers so they're able to congregate more. Metro says that, you know, 60% or so of those students, when those routes were taken away, only 60% of students were using them. Another 40% were using standard Metro routes anyway. And then you have the police weighing in, saying, you know, when issues in Government Square happened earlier this year with two kind of high profile assaults that were caught on video of these groups of kids, you know, attacking people. The police are saying everyone needs to come together and step up. So, yeah, there is a big question of sort of whose shoulders does it fall on. And I don't think any of these single organizations want to say, like, I'm where the buck stops. And that's causing kind of this circular, I don't want to call it finger pointing, but it's this circular sort of, there's this that needs to be taken care of by this organization, and this that, and these people should do this, and this other organization should do that. And there's some conflict there.
Does the school district ever take away students' bus passes when there are problems? And I guess I wonder, you know, I imagine doing that can cause problems for students who have complicated family situations, Cameron.
Exactly. And if a person misuses their bus pass, I'm sure there's an escalation of discipline. They don't discuss individual discipline with students. They're not allowed to, but they are and have taken away people's bus passes for misusing them or for being involved in some of this stuff. Again, I don't know if it's like the very first time or if there's some sort of, I don't know what that escalation looks like, but they are capable of doing that. And yeah, there's been talk of like limiting the kids to specific routes, and that raises issues when they go somewhere different after school. If they come into school from their mom's house and they go to their dad's house across town, or if they have extracurriculars, that can be an issue for kids like that. There are other situations where police have suggested, or at least the president of the FOP union has suggested, that if a student is suspended, that those bus passes be like deactivated, not like taken away, but like you can't get on a bus if you're on suspension because they don't have to get to school. But the schools come back and say, you know, there are a lot of policies that we have to follow in regards to this transportation issue. They are legally obligated to get these kids to and from school. Not only CPS kids, they're legally obligated to get all kids to school. So if they kids go to parochial school or private schools or charter schools in Cincinnati, CPS is still obligated to get them there. So they say that there's a lot of policies and a lot of things, a lot of rules that they have to follow when it comes to this. So it complicates the issue as well.
Zach, the school district had a community meeting about this problem earlier this week. What did you hear from students there?
Well, there was only a small number of students there. Two of them did speak briefly during the meeting and basically said, like, hey, you know, this is it's tough for students right now. There are a lot of frustrations they're experiencing. You know, social media is a whole thing as well. So there are a lot of kind of factors contributing to some of their anxieties and kind of frustrations in the world. And they also said that they weren't really being heard by adults. They said a lot of the adults that they interact with on a daily basis, they don't really feel listened to. They don't feel like they're being taken seriously because they're kids, because they're young. So there wasn't a huge number of students at the meeting this week. I know the school district is hoping to get more of them. They're planning another meeting down the road. But that's basically what they said is, you know, adults aren't really listening to kids when it comes to this issue about what they really need as far as discipline and structure.
Mm-hmm. What did you hear from community members?
Well, I heard a wide variety of things. I think there was a good number of people at this meeting, and I think just about all of them came with a different idea. So certainly people said that there needs to be more discipline. You have to have a stronger hand with these kids. But a lot of people said that, you know, there needs to be a more holistic approach to this. You need to reach out to the parents. You need to reach out to these communities and kind of build up these communities before you start disciplining these kids, because the way they're acting out is just a product of that. So that was certainly one of the ideas. But also the mayor was there. And he said that one of the biggest issues is access to weapons, access to guns. You know, some of these kids have said that, you know, I could get a gun the same day if I just asked for it. It's pretty easy. So I know some of the city people, city manager as well, mentioned that, you know, we need to address the gun issue, the weapons issue. Access to these violent weapons is too easy, and you know, kids are emotional and reactive, so it's easy for them to kind of get a hold of these things in a quick instant. So those were some of the ideas there. There were also a number of community groups there that said, you know, we've tried to reach out to the CPS, reach out to school district and individual schools and kind of build relationships, so have access to kids and get them involved in different programs, but they weren't having any success. I know there was one person there that was saying, I was trying to get a program going here last year, and I was only able to get in contact with somebody a few months ago. So those were some of the things that people brought up. A lot of people had a lot of different ideas, and certainly they didn't come to any kind of consensus on this. But I think generally people said that CPS really needs to start building some relationships with some of these organizations that are geared towards the youth, geared towards these kids, and want to get them involved in different activities outside of just hanging out at the bus stop after school.
Cameron, you mentioned before that Cincinnati Public Schools has had this busing relationship with Metro for many, many years and used to have these separate routes. Cincinnati Federation of Teachers President Julie Sellers told you that teachers were worried problems like this could happen when the busing system changed. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as the the changes were announced that Metro, you know, made the decision to get rid of some of these school specific routes for kids. There was immediate backlash from the board, the superintendent. At one point, Metro was saying, like, we're going to cancel our contract with you. It's been going on for several years. And I think the issues with the kids congregating downtown and everything, that's something that is a little bit more recent. I mean, the kids congregating maybe isn't more recent, but the issues, like the problems that people were having, are more recent to like this year. But yeah, Judy Sellers said, you know, we all told him it was going to happen. And, you know, in response to that, Metro has said, you know, most like almost over 40% of kids were like not riding buses, not riding those routes at that time. So, it's a lot of back and forth with it. And, it's definitely not been a great situation. The response from the school district has also been when the staff said, you know, when the police said, you should have your own people out here to help kind of engage these kids. There's union contracts involved. The staff at these schools are union staff, and they're working outside of those hours and paying them overtime. Like that, some of that stuff isn't in these contracts. So, it makes it really hard, I think, to navigate.
Zach, what did the interim superintendent say the next steps would be with this situation?
Well, after the meeting was held, a few of us reporters got together and asked her a few questions. And she is planning another community meeting. She said November 1st. Now, that is a Friday. So I don't know about the likelihood of holding a community meeting on a Friday night. But it seems like in the next month or so, they're planning to have another community engagement session and trying to get more parents and students involved in that.
Did she seem to think there were some important or good ideas that came out of this discussion with, I know you said there weren't a ton of students there, but with the students who were there, with the community members who were there?
She actually didn't have a solid answer on that. You know, there was a lot of ideas thrown around in that hour and a half that we were there. So she didn't identify any individual ideas that she thought was good, but she said she's considering it at all right now.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine she must think there's something they can do because she's going to have another meeting. So did she seem hopeful?
She seemed hopeful, and she's definitely open to some more ideas, it seems. But, you know, right now, as far as like a rock solid plan, there doesn't really seem to be one right now.
Okay. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight and WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thank you so much.
Up next, the complicated legacy of baseball legend Pete Rose. This is Cincinnati Edition. Cincinnati baseball legend Pete Rose died Monday. He was 83. Major League Baseball's controversial hit king spent most of his career as a Cincinnati Reds player and player manager. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Rose was loved by fans for how he played, but his days in the sport ended under a cloud as he was accused of illegal gambling and banned from baseball and later the Hall of Fame. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about Pete Rose and his legacy is Cincinnati Reds historian and former Cincinnati Enquirer, reporter, and columnist John Arardi. Welcome back, John.
Hi, Lucy. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Let's start with this question that so many people are wondering. Does the lifetime ban go away after Pete Rose's death?
Not automatically. Even though it's called a lifetime ban, what we're talking about here is whether or not Pete will get into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And in order to do that, he has to be removed from the permanently ineligible list. And nobody that was ever placed on that has ever been taken off it, including the great Shoeless Joe Jackson, who was part of the throwing of the World Series of 1919 to the Cincinnati Reds. So unless they both come off that list, I would argue together, I don't think there's any chance either one will ever get into the Hall of Fame.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about why he's not eligible for the Hall of Fame, because Major League Baseball made this decision, but the fact that he wouldn't get into the Hall of Fame, that wasn't an automatic given when he was banned, was it?
No, that was actually a Baseball Hall of Fame rule. They're the ones who decided, and it was called the Pete Rose rule back then, that if you were placed on a permanently ineligible list, you could not go into the Hall of Fame. So again, that's called the Pete Rose rule. That's why it was enacted, and it kept guys like me, who are Hall of Fame voters, from voting on Pete for the Hall. So it was taken out of our hands, basically left in the Hall of Fame's hands. And again, unless he's taken off the permanently ineligible list, he can never go into the Hall. So that's where we're stuck right now.
Hmm. Pete was part of the Big Red Machine and Great Eight. Of his teammates, who are some that you think will miss him most, and what do you think they'll miss most about him?
Well, I think the one that would miss him the most is arguably Joe Morgan, the great second baseman. Those two were like peas in a pod. When Joe came over here for the 1972 season in a trade from the Houston team, they just hooked up together, and basically Pete became a great mentor to Joe and said, if you play it our way, the way we play here in Cincinnati, you'll make the Hall of Fame someday. And sure enough, that's what happened. Joe said he raised his game another level, largely to match his Rose enthusiasm and fire for the game. And that put Joe in the Hall, and probably would have put, no question, Pete into the Hall as well. But no doubt that Tony Perez, the great first baseman in the Hall of Fame, will miss Pete greatly, because they played together in 1960, in the first year of professional baseball in Geneva, New York. And I think even Johnny Bench will miss him. Despite their difficulties over the years, I think Johnny realized that Pete brought out the best in the team, and Johnny had to be for that, because as Johnny knows, until Joe came along in 72, the team had never won a world championship and didn't even win it in 1972 against the Oakland A's. But they did win it back-to-back in 75 and 76. So Johnny would recognize that as well. But anybody on that team would miss this guy, because he was basically the paycheck. He was the breadwinner. He was the guy that put him over the top.
Well, and it's funny, because he wasn't the guy hitting big home runs, right? That wasn't really his role. What made him so important to the team?
I think one thing that I read just today was that the great Ted Williams said that the one record Pete had, which will never be broken, were his number of times at bat. He just played so many games. He played 162 games. If that was the season length, it was a strike-shortened season. He played all the games. He very rarely missed a game. He had that great endurance. So that, along with the fact that he was part of 1,972 victories, which he says makes him the biggest winner in the history of sports, all those things put him over the top, as well as his great ability. And you mentioned some of his liabilities. He did not have great speed, yet he hit a lot of doubles because he always went for the extra base. That head first slide is what made him distinctive. Roger Angel, the great writer, the poet laureate of baseball, said that the one thing that will distinguish Pete is the fact that he played with such joy and such fire. And I would argue that nobody in the history of the game, except for Willie Mays, Joe DiMaggio, and Babe Ruth, transcended the game the way Pete Rose did. His biographer, Kostya Kennedy, called him an American original, and I couldn't agree more.
Why do you think he spent so many years lying about the fact he bet on baseball?
It's the same reason he got 4,256 hits. He couldn't accept reality, and anybody can get 4,000 hits, George Brett told me, that's a totally different dimension than we've ever seen in baseball, except for Ty Cobb. And I think Pete just felt as though he could outlast baseball. He thought he could outlast the commissioners. He felt that ultimately he would get his due. And even when he admitted he bet on the game, it was in a book called My Prison Without Bars. So it was a book for profit, in which he profited from the admission of guilt. I think the guy was just incredibly hard-headed, but again, that's what allowed him to get so many base hits. He was just a different cat. He looked at things a different way than the rest of us do.
It wasn't just gambling with Pete Rose. He faced other scandals that tarnished his record. I mean, in 2017, a woman alleged that Rose slept with her when she was 14 or 15. Pete Rose claimed he believed she was 16, which is the age of consent in Ohio. He was then removed from inclusion in a Wall of Fame ceremony for the Phillies, although the Phillies later did honor him. How do we reconcile with Pete Rose's full legacy, not just the player, but the man?
Lucy, many people feel as though you have to base the privilege of these players going into the Hall of Fame on their playing record alone, how they performed between the white lines. But as long as there's that character clause, the voters such as myself are duty-bound to abide by that. And unless you can get by the scandals you're talking about, and arguably the most reprehensible of all of them is the fact that he was a sex predator. He admitted under oath that he had had sex with a girl underage. Now, he, in his mind, and I found this beyond reprehensible, that he would say, well, I thought she was 16. Well, what kind of defense is that? I mean, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. So for him to say that, that alone is a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing to say. It's a terrible thing to do. And I think that along with the gambling, and it really doesn't matter if you bet for or against your team, but even exceeding that in my mind is what you just spoke of. And I think for that reason, it's going to be very, very difficult for Pete ever to get into the Hall of Fame.
You know, you mentioned the betting and betting on baseball. Do you think there's any way that Pete Rose is a scapegoat of sorts for the league and the entire industry? I mean, one player who he's a player who bet on baseball, but now we have legalized sports betting in Ohio and lots of places around the country. Betting on the game is still against the rules for the players, but the state and the leagues, you know, they're seeing the profits.
Yes, that's definitely true. And I have difficulty with that as well. But the one distinction, again, I would make there is that you cannot have players betting on the game. You simply can't do it because it calls the integrity of the game into question. We've already seen some players in different sports basically sanctioned by their sport for having bet on their game. And again, it's not just betting against your team that's the issue. It's even betting for your team, because if you're not betting for your team on that night, then arguably you're betting against them, and the gamblers know that. You don't think your team's going to win, so that could arguably be construed as betting against your team. The other thing is that if you have money on the game, arguably you might manage the game differently. Say an April game in which maybe typically you would save your bullpen, save your relievers from having to pitch so much early in the season so they would be available later in the year. If you had a lot of money on the game, you might not make that decision. You might go ahead and pitch the guy even though he might have a sore arm or a tired arm, and then it costs you later in the season. So that's why there's no distinction made between for or against. But bottom line is that you cannot have players betting on the game. That's one big difference.
And that was a very clear rule from the beginning of Pete's career, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's in every clubhouse. You cannot bet on the game. And it goes back to 1919. Basically, it's the rule that saved baseball, along with Babe Ruth hitting a lot of home runs in 1920. That terrible decision by the White Sox in 1919 to throw that World Series called into question the very integrity of the sport. And that's why the commissioner, who was brought in for that purpose, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, banned eight players, including Shoeless Joe Jackson, because of their decision to take part in the throwing of that World Series. That particular stain on the game has never gone away. And as long as that exists, that's another reason why I think the commissioner of baseball really won't see past that in order to put Pete into the Hall. I just don't think he can rise to that level. It's just too ingrained in the game.
How will you remember Pete Rose?
Well, when I first came to town in 1974 as a 21-year-old to work for the Cincinnati Enquirer, I was a lifelong baseball fan. I wasn't from Cincinnati, but I always loathed Pete Rose. I couldn't stand the guy. I thought he was a hot dog. I thought he was way too arrogant. But after 1 week of watching him play in Cincinnati, he became my favorite player. And I can't get over that fact because he won people over by the great joy and the fire with which he played. So that's how I'll remember him. I'll remember the fact that he didn't just slide head first. He did, as Barry Larkin said, launched himself in the second, third base and home. I'll remember that he played 500 games at five different positions and made the All-Star team at those five positions, left field, right field, third base, second base, first base. The man was a workhorse. And I think that for that reason, again, I would put him right there with Mays, DiMaggio, and Ruth as the only four guys who transcended the game. That's the greatest praise I can give anybody, to lump them with those three guys. Those are the greatest transcendent players in the history of the game.
We've talked about how complicated Pete Rose's legacy is. How do you think Cincinnati should remember him?
I think largely the same way I just said. There's people in town who I think maybe not many people from the West Side, where Pete was born and raised, but other people in Cincinnati who justifiably feel he disgraced the game and he disgraced Cincinnati. And I cannot argue with that. But I think he'll be remembered in the end as somebody who really was what baseball was all about because of the way he played. And I think that's the memory of him that is going to endure. Now, the issue, I think, you know, Charlie Hustle, which was his nickname, was always intended to be a commendation for the way he played the game. He always hustled. My gosh, he ran out walks to first base. But that said, Charlie Hustle now has come to mean, well, he was hustling. He was hustling the game. He was betting on the game. And I don't think we'll forget that either. So it's a complex legacy. I think both sides need to be remembered. But ultimately, I think the baseball side will win out.
Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Reds historian and former Cincinnati Inquirer reporter and columnist John Arardi. Thanks so much for your time today, John.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.